Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Ellen Belcher with Politics Ohio. Ida Liefskovsky reports on a new voucher program for special education students. WCPN's Ann Glauser will tell us about a new therapy for people with schizophrenia. And Clark County reporter Wayne Baker speaks with the author of a new book that chronicles the life of former slave and Clark County newspaper owner Daniel Rudd. He influenced changes in the Catholic Church and American society after the Civil War. First, let's head out to the Beaver Creek Community Theater.
Shifting.
Next week, Beaver Creek Community Theater will premiere a musical play written by David Brush and Jim Farley. David Brush is the director of programs for Muse Machine and the artistic director of Encore Theater Company. It's the second time he and Farley have collaborated on a musical.
Hey, Billy, what brings you back in town, man?
Just can't stay away, I guess.
Perfect. They're reopening the drive-in again. It's going to be me, you, the whole gang back in town together.
Big Picture actually started as a seed idea about the heyday of the American drive-in theater, which was this tremendously wonderful trend that began to fade sort of in the 60s and 70s, but it really was sort of the all-American gathering place for most of the 50s. And by the time the 60s rolled around, we saw all of these, and we still see them, these dilapidated drive-ins. So that was the centerpiece of the show. And really what I wanted to talk about was a family struggling with turmoil. And at the center of that show is really the relationship between a mother and a son and coming to terms with being a single mother in a time in this country when it was uncommon and certainly not talked about.
Any personal experience go into writing the script?
No, really. And usually that's true, right? Write what you know. But it really isn't. I think it's my own fascination with this era in this country and the American fascination with the cinema. And there used to be this time in the cinema where you dressed up and you put on a tie and a suit and coat and went to the theater. And we've sort of lost that old Hollywood sense. And I think that that must have been a lovely time to be around Hollywood and the cinema.
David Brush says the writing process is evolutionary, and in the end, it's often the collaboration with others that pulls the piece together.
I had done a workshop of that show some years ago. It would have been 2001, 2002. And then it sort of sat on a shelf like shows do. And then you go on to other projects and you do other things. And Doug Lloyd had called and said, you know, I'd love to read your work. And I said, well, all right. So I dusted off and sent it to him. And I'd sent him several shows that I'd written. And he came back and said, you know, I really love this piece and I think we can do something with it. And I said, okay, great. But give me some time to rewrite. It had been so long since I'd revisited it that I really wanted to take a look at it again and see if everything was there that I wanted to be. And Doug was very generous about allowing me to make those changes. And we even wrote a new song for the show and moved things to second act. So there's a lot of changes that have been made. So I'm eager to see it on its feet.
Dear Billy.
Dear Ellie.
It wasn't my intention to.
I hope it wasn't me that made you leave that way. I'm sorry.
It was my choice, my decision.
My name is Doug Lloyd. I'm the current president of Beaver Creek Community Theater, and I'm directing the show The Big Picture.
I wish that you were here and I didn't feel this way. I hope you understand why I couldn't go with you.
It's the story of Billy Carson, who's coming home after his first summer at college. He has never known his father, who died when he was an infant. He's seeking answers about his father and also is seeking answers about life, meets a high school sweetheart or girl he had a crush on in high school, and tries to spend the summer getting to know her better and start that relationship. And she has devils of her own that she's dealing with. And so there's several subplots throughout the show.
When you take my hand, why I can't remember what to say. And I don't comprehend why my eyes will tend to water every time you look my way.
The Big Picture is music intensive, and Lloyd says learning that music is just one of the challenges for the 7-member cast and other crew members.
It's actually very difficult music with lots of words that is difficult to memorize, but it's a totally different process from performing a regular show. With a regular show, you've a lot of times have seen it before, you've at least read the script, you might have a CD of someone else who's done it or whatever, and this was all brand new to the cast from the very beginning, changes made throughout. So, you know, 1 week they might have started to memorize lines and we had to come back and say, well, this has to change, and we've made changes to songs, they'd gotten songs learned, and something things just weren't right, so we made cuts or made additions or whatever. So it's a completely different process, much more challenging than performing just a regular, already done show.
Is that more of a challenge for a smaller community theater, or does it come down to the talent of the actors?
It can be. I'm fortunate to have a really, really talented cast here. They've all been very cooperative. They've all worked their butts off to get it. And they can't say there haven't been bumps in the road, but they've weathered those well and done their best, and I think we're going to have a great production.
You've been directing shows for some time now in the Dayton area. Tell me a little bit about this and how it fits in with what you've done in the past.
It doesn't fit in much at all with what I've done in the past. I've been involved in theater for well over 40 years. I've been directing in the Dayton area for 20 to 25 years. It's just a totally different animal when you start from scratch and are working with something that's never been done before. It was a real challenge. I've gotten a few more gray hairs through the process, but it's a challenge that I wanted to take and was thrilled to have the opportunity to do.
My eyes will adjust from the light of your touch. I just need a moment to take it all in. Will I wake from this dream, lose the heat from this beam, or have I underestimated you?
The world premiere of The Big Picture from writers David Brush and Jim Farley, directed by Doug Lloyd, hits the Beaver Creek Community Theater stage Friday, March 2nd, and runs through the 11th. You can get the full schedule at bctheater.org. This is WISO Weekend.
Will I wake from this dream? Lose the heat from this beam? Or have I underestimated you? And what a little moonlight can do.
For 5 years, Ohio has offered taxpayer-funded vouchers for students in failing public schools to attend private schools. Now the state is expanding the program to include special education students. State Impact Ohio's Ida Liavskovsky reports the voucher program expansion is good news for some families, but alarming to the local public schools they're leaving behind.
When Corinne Link was in third grade, her teachers noticed that she had unusual trouble with reading comprehension. But thanks to the help of a tutor, Corinne, now in eighth grade, reads nearly at grade level.
Emerged into a dingy alleyway that seemed to be made up.
Corinne starts high school next year and hopes that a small Catholic school like Villa Angela St. Joseph on Cleveland's east side will help her continue her progress.
Yeah, I picked the school because it was a smaller class size and that they had the extra help that I would need there.
Corinne's mother, Carrie, says they'll be using the new voucher program aimed at helping special ed students. Corinne is eligible for $7,600, which just covers tuition at the school. Under the old voucher system, she would have had to pay the full tuition, out of reach for Carrie, who is a single mom.
With the scholarship, it's giving us the ability to choose where we're able to send her. And I don't know. I think the scholarship is just it's an exciting thing. I think it's opening up doors for parents and children with disabilities, It's allowing kids to go places, to schools that they may not have had a chance to go to.
This is the third expansion of Ohio's voucher program. In 2004, kids with autism became eligible to receive vouchers for private schools. Then in 2006, it was expanded to kids in failing public schools. Now all special needs students attending any school are eligible for vouchers for up to $20,000, depending on the severity of their disability.
What do you think? Is it more likely someone lives 2 feet from school?
2 miles.
2 miles. Nice job.
Youngstown Christian Academy is a state-approved special needs provider.
How much?
Eight quarters.
Nice job, Tanner. Give me 5.
School president Mike Pecchia says about 10% of his student population is special needs, and he expects that to increase with the new voucher program. He's already planning some renovations and expansions to meet the increased demand.
It has been good for us.
Still, Youngstown Christian is a pretty small school. There are just 475 students in grades K through 12. Pecchia says parents are drawn to the school's small size.
The important thing for the parents is they're progressing educationally, but they're also eating lunch with kids. They're in gym class with kids. Where I think a lot of what their experiences were in a lot of the public schools is they weren't doing that. Those kids were sort of isolated.
Deb Dennis takes issue with that last point. She's the director of special needs services at the public Avon schools on the west side of Cleveland.
We work hard to really keep up with everything that's going on in special education and provide what is, in our opinion, really strong programming. So that's what's frustrating, when somebody walks away from that to something that, in our opinion, isn't quite as strong.
Dennis was not happy to hear the state's voucher program is expanding again. Here's why. Public school districts have to write yearly special individual education programs, or IEPs, for special needs students, even if those students attend a private school. And it's the public school, not the private school the child attends, that has to monitor the progress of the special ed student and update the plan.
My first thought is frustration, just because it puts some responsibility on the school for kids that they won't really know.
The private schools and parents are supposed to communicate regularly with the student's home district. What makes that pill even harder for public schools to swallow is the financial hit they take. Students who use the new voucher program will take their state funding, that is up to $20,000, from their local public school district to a private school, tutor, or other approved provider.
Basically, the check will go to the provider with the parent that will have to sign off on it also.
Cheryl Bowser is the Special Needs Outreach Coordinator for School Choice Ohio, a Columbus-based advocacy group that supports vouchers and charter schools.
But, you know, it's usually try to make it not about the money, but about what's best for that child.
Bowser says public schools get extra funding for special needs students, and that funding should follow the student to whatever school they choose, just like it does with the regular school voucher program. For State Impact Ohio, I'm Ida Liaskovsky.
State Impact Ohio is an education reporting collaboration of NPR and Ohio Public Radio stations WCPN, WKSU, and WOSU. For more education reporting, go to the website stateimpact.npr.org/Ohio. Normally, when you hear the word schizophrenia, what comes to mind are hallucinations, delusions, paranoia, even violent outbursts. But this is a story about what happens after people with the disease have been stabilized with antipsychotic medications. For several years now, Cleveland has been the incubator for a new therapy that helps people with schizophrenia get to the next level. Reporter Ann Glauser from member station WCPN has the story.
Megan Michaels and I met up in Richmond Heights to take Buddy for a walk. Michaels is a professional dog walker. She has been for 6 years. Michaels has schizophrenia. That's not how she'd normally introduce herself, nor could you tell when you meet her, but she has agreed to talk with me about her illness and what helped her.
This way, Buddy. Come on. Come on.
Michaels loves her job. She's stable. When she has bad days, feeling low or isolated, she knows how to handle it.
I have to essentially pull myself out of my skin and realize that everybody has these kinds of days. The only difference is I have a few more of these days.
But it hasn't always been like this. When she was first diagnosed with schizophrenia in college, she says it was terrifying and traumatic. It required hospitalization.
When you first get the illness, you have no insight on what's happening to you. And you're scared.
She was stabilized with antipsychotic meds, but had trouble keeping on track, making plans, and thinking clearly. 10 years ago, Michaels, who is now 41, enrolled in a new program developed to help people like her. It's called Cognitive Enhancement Therapy, or CET. CET aims to train areas of the brain thought to be impaired in people with schizophrenia. People in the program do extensive drills on the computer that target memory, attention, and problem solving. The one-year intensive program also has group sessions which teach social skills, like how to interact with your coworkers. I visited a recent CET class run by the Jewish Family Service Association in Cleveland. Students were at computers doing exercises that honestly were making my head spin. Like, you'd see the word red printed in yellow lettering. First round, you had to match the word color. Second round, you had to match the word meaning. The exercises get progressively harder, and you're trying for speed as well. This is all part of the plan to help students adapt to different situations and develop so-called cognitive flexibility. Recent studies show CET resulted in lasting improvements in memory, attention, and social skills for people with schizophrenia. Dr. Sophia Vinogradov is a psychiatrist at the University of California, San Francisco, and studies brain training programs like CET.
Right now, the standard of care for people with schizophrenia is, in this country anyway, abysmally unambitious, I guess you could say.
People are stabilized with meds and sometimes counseling.
But they really don't do anything in terms of helping people get back integrated into their community, you know, able to work.
This is the aim of CET, and Vinogradov says its dual emphasis on cognitive and social skills means it's an approach with a lot of promise. Megan Michaels says her most important takeaway from the program is the impact it has had on her interactions with family, friends, coworkers, even strangers like me.
It's helped me accomplish better relationships.
She's held down her job, she's been married for 9 years, and she agreed to do a radio interview about a stigmatized illness. This is the kind of outcome that developers of CET hope for. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Ann Glosser in Cleveland.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. Today I'm talking to Joe Hallett, a senior editor at the Columbus Dispatch and a longtime Ohio political journalist. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Happy to be with you, Ellen.
Super Tuesday, when Ohio and 9 other states weigh in on who should be the Republicans' presidential candidate, is just a little more than a week away. What can Ohio voters expect in the run-up to March 6th?
Well, they can expect to see the candidates here even more than they already have. We've had, in the last 2 weeks, Newt Gingrich taking a two-day bus tour through Ohio. We've seen Rick Santorum. Mitt Romney was in Cincinnati just the other day, and he also will be back.
You've been following these candidates when they've been in the state. What are you seeing on the campaign trail? I mean, what's the level of passion out there? What are voters telling you that they really care about?
The Republican primary is different, obviously, than the general election. So it's a very conservative, religious-oriented base, the folks who are going to get out and actually vote. The Tea Party faction also is very strong in Ohio. So the candidates are weighing in with a very conservative message. They are, of course, focusing on the economy, talking more about tax cuts and helping small businesses and that sort of thing.
Have there been any moments that have really struck you, moments where you thought, wow, this guy is really striking a chord, he's sensing something about what people want to hear?
Yeah, you can feel that way a lot when you follow Newt Gingrich. He really has a command of the rhetoric, and particularly the kind of rhetoric that the Republican base wants to wants to hear. He is more of a red meat candidate than Romney or Santorum. And you will hear the loudest cheers at his rallies, as I heard when I followed him for a couple of days up from Cincinnati to Columbus. He just does know how to connect. You contrast that. I went to Cuyahoga County Republican dinner up near Cleveland, where Romney gave the keynote speech, and he failed to connect totally. It was just kind of a collection of strung together cliches, and there was not a lot of passion in the room.
Senator Rob Portman, who's on all the shortlists for vice president, is behind Governor Romney. Former senator and now attorney general Mike DeWine had endorsed Governor Romney, but recently flipped to Rick Santorum. What was behind that reversal, and how divided are Ohio's Republican leaders?
Well, behind the DeWine endorsement, more than anything, was friendship. He and Santorum and their two wives were very close when they were in the Senate together. They palled around together, and I think DeWine will tell you that early on he endorsed Romney and actually became a Romney delegate because, like so many people, he didn't see Santorum having much of a chance. But as Santorum continued his rise, DeWine said he started having sleepless nights about maybe this guy could become president, and he is my friend, and you know, I think he just started to feel bad. So it was more personal than anything.
Tell us how the primaries that come before us in Michigan and Arizona impact the importance of Ohio's vote.
Michigan could have a huge impact on Ohio's vote, I think, because the states are similar in so many ways and have shared the same kind of economic problems. It is Romney's home state. He is expected to win there, although he did have a close race there against McCain in 2008. If he were to lose, and the Romney people just downplay this, but it would be big. I mean, to lose your home state would be symbolically very big.
I've been talking with Joe Hallett, a senior editor with the Columbus Dispatch. It was great hearing your take, Joe. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, Ellen.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WISO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. As Black History Month comes to a close, WISO's Wayne Baker reports on a new book about a 19th century African-American, Daniel Rudd, a former slave who lived in Springfield, Ohio, and helped change the face of the Catholic Church. Gary Agee wrote the book. He's an adjunct at Anderson School of Theology in Anderson, Indiana, and leads a small congregation in Preble County.
Well, Daniel Rudd was born a slave in Bardstown, Kentucky. He was educated. We're not sure, you know, who actually stepped forward to aid him in that process, but we know that as an adult, he read and spoke fluent German. So we imagine the Jesuits there at Bardstown helped him with his early education, his primary education. He moved to Springfield. He was ambitious. He was a go-getter. He started working with a paper there in Springfield, Ohio, called The Review. He's remarkable. I mean, he wanted justice for African Americans. He wanted full equality. And so he worked there while he was in Springfield to integrate the schools. He founded his own newspaper, the Ohio State Tribune, in 1885. And it really was on the brink of a failure when for whatever reason, maybe in dialogue with Catholic leaders, he decided to move it, along with partner James T. Whitson, to Cincinnati in 1886, and he rechristened it the American Catholic Tribune, and he published that paper for 11 years. It had 10,000 subscribers at its zenith. He founded a printing operation to go along with his paper. He established a printing school to apprentice black printers. He ran a national newspaper, weekly newspaper. He employed, 20, 30 people in his operation. He was known, he was widely desired as a speaker and lecturer, apparently a gifted lecturer. He founded the Black Catholic Congress movement, which still is in existence today and meets regularly, and they meet in Indianapolis this year. He was one of the co-founders of the Lay Catholic Congress movement. And interestingly enough, when his paper collapsed in 1897, he moved south, and he started all over again, basically. He ran a lumber mill in Bolivar County, Mississippi, in a place called Boyle. He met a guy named Scott Bond in 1912. Scott Bond was the first black millionaire in Arkansas, and Bond asked him to come and work for him and run his lumber mill operation. So he moved over to Madison, Arkansas, and he started working there. And he invented a gravel loading machine, or designed a gravel loading machine, that really earned Bond, it looks like, tens of thousands of dollars. And so Rudd was a very accomplished man. He wasn't just a man of letters. You know, he had more than a golden tongue.
And let me ask you the significance of his putting together the Colored Catholic Congress. What was the impetus then? Did he see that there were a lot of African Americans that were interested in the Catholic Church? Did he feel that the Catholic Church could better serve the community?
Okay, that's a very good question. I think, first of all, you have to understand that Rudd believed in black agency. In other words, he believed that blacks should help themselves. They should work on the, quote, colored question, end of quote. He was a man of action. You know, he didn't want to sit around and beg for a job. He believed that African Americans should get out and start companies and hire blacks and whites, too, and set a good example that way. I mean, he said those kind of things. And so Rudd decided, look, we can help solve these issues that we see as justice concerns, like issues with the school, lack of education for African Americans, a lack of jobs. Let's get together. You know, let's work on these problems together. And so that's the reason he founded this movement, is really to assemble this cadre of people that would work on these issues.
I'm also fascinated with his ties to journalism. It seems like he was very well-read, very well-educated.
Mm-hmm.
Did that lead him into the newspaper journalism business?
You know, I think that if you were concerned with justice and if you were concerned with the rights of African Americans, I think that journalism was a natural fit. Editorial advocacy, speaking out. And interestingly enough, something that I learned doing research for the book is that there were more papers, black papers, established after the end of Radical Reconstruction up to during the time that Jim Crow really, you know, develops in the South. There were more African-American newspapers established during this period of history than any other period of history. And so if you were an African-American interested in, you know, justice issues, hey, look, you gravitated toward journalism and to work in these newspapers and let your voice be heard. And so oftentimes there was not an opportunity in the white press to do that. And so African-Americans established these newspapers.
Interesting. I think many people currently living in Springfield in the area would be fascinated with that history. And I also read the quote attributed to Rudd, "We think we will live long enough to see a black man president of this republic." How appropriate. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Let me say a word about that. Standing up in 2008, and Barack Obama had just won the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And so I stand up, and I open with this quote in my defense, my doctoral defense there at the University of Dayton. I mean, it's just so surreal. Here we've got this guy that's and I'm talking about Daniel Rudd, and he made this claim, and it looked like it was going to come to pass, you know, that we may well have a black president in 2008. And in fact, Rudd was right. His dates weren't quite right, but he was always an optimist and always looking forward, you know, to what America could do if it also lived up to its founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, that kind of thing.
WISO's Wayne Baker speaking with author Gary Agee. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. But before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour.
Tonight's radio documentary is An Imperfect Revolution, Voices from the Desegregation Era. The 1970s saw a tidal change in American race relations. For the first time, large numbers of white, black, and other children of color began attending school together. It was an experience that shaped them for life. Nearly everyone who experienced school desegregation has a story to tell about crossing racial lines. Together, they reflect an era marked by struggle and hope, anger and idealism. American Radio Works traveled to Louisville, Kentucky and Charlotte, North Carolina to talk with people about their memories of integration. Tonight, we'll hear some of their stories. Using first-person accounts of the era of forced busing, An Imperfect Revolution explores the ways school desegregation changed the nation. An Imperfect Revolution, Voices from the Desegregation Era, tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
Coming up next on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and WYSO.org, The Book Nook.